On this episode of The Flatus Show, number 61A, an interview with podcaster Randy. He's from the Two Guys, One Brain podcast. We talk about football, nerds, fathers, L.A., Orchards, Washington, and business. This and more. The Flatus Show, starring Kenty and Jose. Welcome to the Flatus Show. Tab for my diet. Thanks to Edith Macy. That's from Polyester. Edith Macy plays Cuddles. Dawn Davenport's, or no, not Dawn Davenport's, Francine Fishpaw's maid, who had made it big and became a rich lady. And, yeah, so that's that. Go watch it. What did I say? Polyester, yeah. Polyester. Excellent movie. I saw that first in, what was it, college? It was in college. But anyway, welcome to the Flatus Show. This is Kenty. Jose is in the house taking a nap. And he's a little tired dog. He gets tired these days. You can reach me at Kenty@theflatusshow.com or call me at 206-339-JOSE. You can also come to my website, theflatusshow.com, and find all sorts of links. You'll find the blog, and you'll find the show, the blog where my podcast is, the podcast notes are. So you click on that, and you can listen to the show online. If you come to my website, when you get there, at the very bottom, there's a place to put in your email address, and that is a service through FeedBurner, where every time I update my show, the RSS feed, you're sent an email saying that there's a new show. So if you don't have an aggregator like iTunes or Juice or whatever, this email will let you know when a new show is up. You can actually click the links right in the email and listen to the show from that application, and you'll get all the show notes automatically without having to go to the page. So that's a fun little something fun. I have on my show notes, notice I have a link to my artwork. I have a special picture album for my artwork, and you can look for it there. I'm going to get into there right now so you can see. I have drawings. The Flatus Show. Show artwork. It's theflatusshow.com/Flatus_show art/. And that's the album. We have a wonderful show. It's actually two shows. It's going to be A and B because I have an interview with Randy, the fabulous Randy, from the Two Guys, One Brain. It's a podcast coming out of Vancouver, Washington, and him and his co-host, Andy, talk about their family, their work at the county jail there, and a bunch of other stuff. It's a great show. They're very clever, and it's wonderful. They've been doing it for over a year now, and I recommend it highly. Worth listening to. So, okay, so what do we have here? Frapper Map, you can reach me at go to my Frapper Map, and I think it's frapper.com/TheFlatusShow or Flatus Show or something like that. You'll see notes on my webpage, on the show notes. So come on and sign the Frapper Map. Let me know you're listening. Let's see here. I already talked about the website, artwork, interviews. Oh, pardon me. I want to do more interviews. And so anybody interested in doing interviews, let me know. I'll call you. I want to do Wanda Wisdom's interview. So, Wanda, if you're listening, I want to do your interview. So give me an email. And if you're not listening, well, I guess that's really stupid to say if you're not listening, right? I'll call you. or if somebody knows Wanda Wisdom, email her and tell her I want to do the interview. Let's see here, Ross. Okay, What I Believe podcast is a podcast I do with the ever-popular Big C from the Pulling My Pod podcast from coming right out of Monticello, Georgia. So we got together and we decided to do a podcast about our belief statements and talk about all sorts of different topics and what we think about them and believe about them. So right now we're doing entertainment, and the last one we did was movies. And Big C, I don't know if it's up yet because I didn't see it updated on my iTunes. So that's a little odd. It should be coming out soon. But if you're interested in being on the What I Believe podcast, if you listen to it and are interested in it, let me know. Big C just got a Macintosh computer, so the sound might be better. So we'll find out. Well, on this newest episode, the sound hasn't been that great on the previous ones, but Big C says the sound sounds really good on this newest one we did. Take a listen if you want to be involved with it, or you know, you don't have to be involved with it every week. But if you're interested, let me know and. We'll set you up. I'll have Big C email you, and we do it Tuesday nights around 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Tab. So, this is leads into the What I Believe podcast. We were talking about The Passion, Mel Gibson's Passion movie. And somebody said, I think it's a great Christian movie. And I said, I don't think it's a great Christian movie. You know, don't speak for me, you know. I think it's anti-Semitic. I mean, John and I saw it, and the characters are two-dimensional. I even think all the characters, including Christ and the Romans and the Jews, but the Jews especially are come off as buffoonish and two-dimensional, you know. And Christ is, I mean, you know, he may have been beaten, right? But he was, it's just like, we understand he was beaten, right? I think it was a little bit overkill. I mean, I can't imagine that he was beaten that much. I mean, to that extent. Also, throughout the movie, there was this sort of like androgynous figure who was supposed to be the devil following him around, and a snake and stuff. Which I think is false, you know. I don't think the devil was there at his crucifixion. And I don't think that the snake in the beginning of the Bible was the devil either. I think the snake was just the snake in the Adam and Eve story. I know that might be verboten or whatever, but, you know, let's take it literally. It was a snake, you know. So I don't think you should confuse the devil with that. So anyway. Anyway, I was thinking about Flight 93, and don't you sometimes feel like the, you know, extreme religious right is hijacking the country? So we're like Flight 93, you know? We should all get up and let's roll, you know? Let's do something, because otherwise they're going to crash into our democracy and take it away, you know? So before they get there, let us either ground it or do something, so... my little political statement. Okay. Oh, let's see what else. I don't know. So anyway, I want to get on with the show because it's wonderful, and really the main bulk of this is going to be the Randy interview part one, and then part two, you'll see. And the reason why I split up is just too long for one show with the introduction and a song and everything, because I like to do two songs anyway a week, and since this is would be long, I can only have one song per show. And hope you enjoy the songs, the ukulele. So, anyway, on with the show. Lash! That's Brenda Staria here, finishing up her scoop just for you. Brenda Star. Let's see where we left off. Jig was in Brenda's room after she got back from talking to Mike Mooney, and he was sort of giving her the heavy arm to try to see what he knew. She found out from Mike. So Brenda breaks free, and Jig says that, you know, he's Lula's protector, and he doesn't trust Brenda, and that's the reason why he's acting that way. So Brenda reports to Lula, who's downstairs, and she had been napping, about her findings from Mike Mooney, And at this time, right, at the same as this is going on, Jig is driving away. And Lula tells Brenda that Jig apologizes for the way he behaved. It seems he confesses to her whenever he acts badly, you know, when he has bad behavior like a little boy. Also, we find that young Jig, who knows Lula, who's 85, very well, and he knows her like Darth knew her. And apparently they're lovers, too. The last panel shows Jig talking to someone in the shadows, watching a Lula movie. So, Jig has driven away, and he's talking to somebody, and he says that he's close, that he has Lula wrapped around his finger, but is afraid Brenda could be a kink in the plan. So, Brenda is talking to Lula, and she has learned that Mike Mooney, the only thing Brenda has learned is that Mike Mooney is broke, and that Lula broke his heart. So, Lula said that she broke up the relationship after the baby was taken because she felt betrayed by everyone, and she thought that Mike Mooney knew more about the situation in Darth's disappearance than he was going to tell her. So she just broke off all relationships. She urges Brenda to talk to Mike again to find out what's really going on. So she sees Mike, and he finally confesses that Darth is not dead, because apparently he said that in the first interview, and had seen him a few years ago, and that's where we're at.
Born free as the wind blows, as free as the grass grows, born free to follow your heart. Do-de-do-de-do. Still astounds you each time you look at a star. Stay free where no walls divide you. You're free as a roaring tide, so there's no need to hide. Life is worth living, but only worth living 'cause you're born free.
Me?
Yeah.
I'm just hoping it's not too late for you.
Nope, it's not too late.
Okay, good.
Voot, voot, voot. Yes, I'd like to say something here, is when I interviewed Randy, the first 11 minutes, wasn't recording my voice, and I just recorded his. So I'm leaving it as is because it's pretty clear as to what kind of questions I'm asking him. I did cut down on the silence and stuff, but I did leave some in there so you have the sense that something is going on, because you'll hear muffling, that's me. How that's recorded, I don't know, but anyway, for the first 11 minutes, you'll just hear Randy talking. But you'll understand the questions I have asked him. So I just want to let you know. I was going to say this in the show notes, and I forgot. So anyway, enjoy. Voot, voot, voot.
So how was your shopping experience? Good?
Expensive.
Yeah.
Kids, right? Yeah. Well, all four were here, but only three of them are going to school.
Yeah.
But it worked out for me. Wendy does Shane, and he's still in grade school, so he gets a list of specific things, you know, the kind of markers and the kind of crayons and the kind of paper and all that.
Yeah.
The other two are in higher grades, so I just get them a notebook and some paper and some pens and send them on their way. But I did have to do school clothes for David today.
Oh.
So, you know, $500 later.
Oh my God.
Yeah, the shoes were $80.
Can you believe?
No. When I was a kid, my dad, $80.
Yeah.
These are $4. You're getting these.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I had a fight for clothing, I suppose.
I had a buddy who said he always got his sister's hand-me-downs, which is pretty funny. He didn't really, but it was funny.
Yeah. That sounds like me, Chris. I had an older sister and said that would have happened. So, I was originally going to talk to you about your football experience in high school. I was never involved with any kind of sports, so it fascinates me to talk to people who did go through that experience.
Sure. I was never a superstar at football. You know, I was never, I was a bigger kid, you know, I was heavy the first year I played anyway. So I was a lineman, which there's not a lot of glory there, you know. You're down in the trenches, no one sees you, they never call your number, you never touch the ball. But you're still part of a team, and I think that's mostly what it's all about at that age anyway.
Voot, voot, voot. Just a note here, football is a very, very old type of sport, which is related to soccer and rugby, American football, that is. And it is, in medieval Europe, it was played by peasants. It meant on foot, footballs on foot, as opposed to games on horseback, which is aristocratic. So it goes back pretty far to at least medieval Europe. But even at that time, it was a rowdy sport, and the kings and royalty tried to make laws against it because it was too rowdy. And some would argue that football even goes back further into Greece and to Rome, too. Voot, voot, voot!
8th, 9th, and 10th. When I got later in high school, junior and a senior, I like I said, I wasn't really a gifted athlete, and there were a lot more guys who were, and I got a job and started earning money instead.
Okay. That's interesting. Okay, so your high school football career was 8th, 9th, and 10th, right?
Yeah. Junior high and high school. We had junior high here.
Yeah, we had junior high too. Okay.
Yeah.
They don't have junior high anymore.
No, they go right from middle school to high school now here. Yeah, well, I'll tell you, the main thing was, like, if you wanted to go out for baseball, you had tryouts and you could be cut. Mm-hmm. They could only have so many people on the team. If you didn't make it, you didn't get to play. Mm-hmm. Basketball, same way. Mm-hmm. They had a golf team, same way. You tried out, and if you were good enough, you made the team. Football, they took everybody. They just needed bodies. Same way with wrestling. I did wrestling also, which is an individual sport in that, you know, you wrestle individually and you either win or you lose, but it's also a team sport because there's a cumulative score for each match that you have with another school. Football, team sport, and frankly pretty manly. That was I was trying to connect with my dad mostly, I think, because he would come to wrestling matches, but it wasn't his thing. He never watched wrestling any other time, but he always watched football. And he had played football, and you know, I was trying to become a man, and all of us who were trying to become men joined the football team. That's just what we did.
Okay. So did you prefer wrestling over football?
No, I actually think I was a little better at wrestling. I excelled more. I liked that I could win something and it would be me. I think I always had winning seasons wrestling-wise, you know, but I wasn't a superstar at that either. I never went to state or anything.
Woot, woot, woot! And if football and the related football sports are old, wrestling is even older. I mean, it goes back to Greek and Roman times. It's been written about. I mean, in the Olympics, wrestling was one of those Olympic sports. In fact, I think it was all done naked and in oil. And there's a Turkish wrestling is in oil, too. And of course, you know, God wrestled Jacob or somebody back there in the Bible. So, you know, that goes back, 4,000 years or whatever. But anyway, wrestling is an old sport.
Voot, voot, voot. Football, it's interesting when you're a kid. Being part of a team, it helps me kind of understand why kids join gangs. It's nice to be a part of something. And like I said, I wasn't really a gifted athlete. There were a lot of guys better than I was, but it sure felt good to put your jersey on and wear it to school on Friday. You know, I mean, there it was a small percentage of us that did that. And on game days, we'd wear our jersey to school, and it was the only time I was cool. So I really enjoyed it. All the rest of the time, I was kind of a dork. I know, I really was. Well, you know, I mean, especially eighth grade and even ninth grade, guys were, you know, the cooler kids. They were developing their bodies and looking like men, you know. I still looked like a dumpy kid in eighth grade. The summer between eighth and ninth grade, I grew like a foot, you know, and dropped a bunch of weight and started looking like a teenage boy. But the first year when I actually started playing sports, I didn't. I didn't stand out in a crowd. I had homemade clothes. You know, my mom would sew my clothes for me to save money. And, you know, she would cut my hair to save money. And so I wasn't cool. I didn't have all the stuff the cool kids had. And it wasn't so much that I repulsed people. Just nobody noticed me in general. And, you know, when you're trying to decide what your identity is, that's devastating. Yeah. You know, I'm 11, 12, 13, and I want a girlfriend like everybody else, and I want to have muscles like everybody else, and I want to wear the cool, it was Nike shoes at that time, I wanted Nikes like everybody else, but no. My dad took me downtown to JCPenney's, and I got two or three pairs of the Levi's 501 straight legs and some, you know, $4 Keds at the Payless, and that's what I wore to school. So you gotta have a lot of cool going for you to overcome stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the homemade shirts are pretty interesting.
Yeah. You know, at the time when she was making them, like, she would sew T-shirts and shirts, and they weren't bad clothes. I mean, she can sew. She's good at it, and it's a talent. And if I had that talent, I would be proud of it. But kids are ruthless, and they were ruthless about it. I mean, it was obvious that I wasn't wearing the designer clothes they were wearing.
Yeah.
So when I got my Letterman's jacket, that was the most expensive thing I owned.
I understand where you're coming from, because I had the same sort of experience.
We were the majority. I mean, there were very few gifted athletes, and there were very few kids who could afford all the really cool stuff that all the rest of us wanted. But for some reason, you know, even though they were the minority in numbers, the rest of us felt like we didn't belong. Mm-hmm. It's kind of odd the way that works, but that's how kids see it.
So, okay, so you have your high junior job. So what was your life like in your...
I got a job, actually, one of the teachers that I had at school, he taught horticulture, and his name was Phil. He was a teacher, but he also had a wholesale nursery. He would grow... like if you go to Home Depot and look in their garden section, the potted plants, azaleas and rhododendrons and arborvitae and all that are in the pots, 1 gallon up to 5 gallons, and trees and things like that. He grew those. Mm-hmm. He produced them. So I started in the summers working for him. And then as I became older and was able to drive, I worked for him more and more. I'd go after school and work. I worked every weekend. I worked all summer. And I discovered... that since I wasn't going to be cool, I wasn't going to be part of the in crowd, I wasn't going to be in the clique there, I might as well have some cash. Mm-hmm. Because I could get things that I wanted by purchasing them, and my dad seemed to approve. Mm-hmm. You know, like if I wanted to buy a stereo, and this happened, I was sort of an audiophile in high school because I really didn't have that much going for me. So that's what I did. I'd buy music, I'd enjoy it, I bought speakers, and I added components and things to my stereo system, and that's what I did with my money. My dad thought that was ridiculous. You know, that's not something he would have ever done, but I earned the money myself, so it was okay. I could do what I wanted, and he halfway approved. Mm-hmm. So that I spent that time, you know, first of all, trying to get out of high school, because I didn't really enjoy it that much. I never had any aspirations of getting out of high school and going to college. I wanted to work and earn money, and I was doing pretty well, you know. the cool kids had money because someone gave it to them, not because they earned it. So there was a sense of accomplishment mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. But I still had a crappy car.
At least you had a car.
Yeah, well, we had this old green Ford Torino.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, we called it the Green Weenie. And I sort of inherited that. I mean, you know, the door handle came off and the windshield was cracked on the passenger side and three of the hubcaps were missing. And, you know, the gas pedal itself came off. There was just a little thing sticking out of the floor down there. I mean, it was a piece of junk. And that car, even though it was a piece of junk and my folks didn't want it, it was not mine. It was never mine. I was able to drive it. And when I wanted to go to work, I could drive it. And when they wanted me to do stuff, I could drive it. But it was still a tool where if I wanted to do something they didn't want me to do, it was their car, and no, you can't use the car.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I didn't really get the sense of ownership until I was a senior in high school when I actually bought a car, and that was the Dodge Dart with the naked lady on the hood.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, my dad wasn't really excited about that purchase. But
I think that was a really funny story. Voot, voot, voot. This story was first told on the Two Guys, One Brain podcast. Don't ask me which number, but it was, you know, in their archive. It's from an earlier part of this year. And you just have to listen to them all.
Yeah, and then later on in my life, I'm married, I have a kid, I'm struggling to make ends meet and just survive.
Yeah.
And out of the kindness of his heart, my dad let me drive his pickup so I could use it to work because I was doing landscaping on my own
mm-hmm.
and I needed a truck. And he drove the Dodge Dart with the naked lady back and forth to work.
Well, that's love, right?
Yeah. So as much as he hated it and as much as it made him mad when I bought it, he really helped me out when I needed it. So, you know.
Well, there you go.
I talk a lot about him, but he is a pretty good guy.
Yeah, he sounds like old school father. You know?
Definitely.
It's, you know, he's remote and, you know, has his own, knows what a man is. I mean, you know,
has his own definition. Idea of what a man is.
Yeah, that's what I meant. You know, the sort of, yeah, you know what I mean.
Yeah, because, I mean, in my world, the way I look at it, I have no problem as a man hugging my children or giving affection to them, even when people are looking. And that would just mortify my father. He wasn't a hugger, you know. I mean, the closest he comes, if he's proud of you, if he thinks you did a good job, if he feels like you're a man, he'll reach out and shake your hand, and that's affection to him. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's just an old school thing, and that's the way he was with his dad, because I remember his dad, and they were that way with each other. They weren't real touchy-feely. Yeah. But, you know, I would kind of want for my kids, for them to have grandparents like I had, who loved me and were very affectionate. You know, and I could tell. I mean, I know he loves his grandkids, but when you're a kid, you want a hug.
Yeah, and so, he doesn't hug.
No, not a hugger.
Yeah, yeah. So you were married after high school, or right after high school, or?
Right out of high school, I graduated in June of '83, and we got married in June of '84.
Jeez.
That's all I really – that was my goal. I mean, I didn't want to go to college and all that. I wanted to get a job, make some money, and have a wife and a family. That had always been my goal. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why. I mean, I'm not sure what motivated me that way, but I really wanted some companionship. I wanted a wife, and I wanted some kids. Mm-hmm. And so that was my goal, and that's what we did. We weren't pregnant when we got married or anything like that. We just decided that's what we were going to do.
That's really interesting. I don't think that's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I think back when I was that age, I was like, yeah. I couldn't have done it. I mean, clearly I wasn't interested in marrying a woman, but even to be in that kind of relationship or whatever, you know, it just was the farthest thing from my mind.
Yeah, I was 18 when we got engaged. I was 18. We graduated from high school. I started a landscaping business, which basically I borrowed the $40 from her, borrowed her car, drove to Olympia, which is the capital here in Washington State, bought my business license and all that, and started basically doing maintenance for real estate companies. There was one in particular here that specialized in relocating executives. So they'd have big fancy houses, and those types of people will just up and move. Like, you know, there's a job for Nike over in Beaverton, so they'll go over there, or there's something in Kansas City, so they'll go there. This company would maintain their houses until they sold, and then they subcontracted to me. So I'd go once a week and mow the lawns and make sure the sprinkler system worked, and whenever they got a new one that had been sitting for a while, I'd go clean it up, haul all the junk away, trim the bushes, make it presentable so they could sell it. So I was actually a subcontractor for that company with my own business license, and then I expanded from there and did other things. But the drawback of that, it was fun. It was good. It was hard work, but you got paid for what you did. And there was a sense of accomplishment there, too. And I've always been sort of a goal-oriented person. Mm-hmm. I don't like busy work. It irritates me. When I was in school, they'd give you a handout. Here, do this because I have something to do for a half hour and I want you to leave me alone. Mm-hmm. That stuff drives me crazy. But if I'm doing something and I get results at the end and I can see that I'm making a difference, I enjoy that. So that really worked for me. The downside was no health insurance, no, you know, if there's no work, there's no money. And we have a definite four seasons here. So in the winter, from October to March, the phone didn't ring. There was no money. So I enjoyed it very much, having my own business. I enjoyed doing that kind of work. I just couldn't survive.
Yeah. Yeah. My father was a landscaper. He had his own business. And did you do anything in the winter? Did you plow or sell firewood? I mean, you know, wood for the fireplaces?
No.
He
what
did
I
that.
Actually, that would have been, actually, I wish I would have thought of that. I lived in an apartment, so I didn't really have anywhere to keep equipment. So like I say, I was using my dad's truck, and I was keeping my things out there. What I did in the winter, he's a truck driver, and he was working for a company at the time that delivered cheese and flour and all the things that a pizza restaurant uses. They specialized in pizza restaurants. He was driving a truck delivering, so he would leave on, you know, Saturday and get home on Wednesday every week. Mm-hmm. Well, that company hired me part-time in the winter at his behest as a warehouse person, loading trucks and things like that. So I survived through the winter that way, and then the following summer I would do my landscaping again. I did that for 2 or 3 years until I realized I wasn't going to get ahead. I was surviving, but I wasn't really doing much for my family. I had Rachel at that time, so I had a wife and a daughter at home, and I could tell I needed some health insurance. I needed to make more money. I needed to get them out of that apartment and make a better life. So I started looking around. I ended up working in a warehouse, got me another job working in a warehouse, but it was full-time, selling, the company sold building products, siding and windows and insulation and stuff like that. So I worked there, and I worked my way from the warehouse to the office manager inside. We hired a new warehouseman, and then I moved up into phone sales, and they hired a new office manager, and then I worked up into outside sales with the company car and the driving around, selling and getting commission checks and making more money. Did that for several years here. Then that company transferred me to Los Angeles.
That's a big difference, right?
Huge, huge. Oh, my gosh, the culture shock from Orchards, Washington, the garage sale capital of the world, to Los Angeles, California was really something.
Orchards, Washington. Now, I looked this up, and here's some interesting facts. A interesting fact. The Hudson Bay Company once owned the land upon which Orchards now sits. And I think in this section, Randy mentions that Orchards, Washington is the garage sale capital of the world. Well, there was a movie made called G-Sale, it's a mockumentary set in Washington, in fictional Bogwood, Washington, which apparently is a place that has more garages per capita than any other town in the USA, and therefore the garage sale capital of the world. So it might be, actually, Bogwood might be based on Orchards, Washington, but there you go. Wow.
My wife and my small child and I moved down there on December 19th in 1989, right before Christmas, and had our Christmas ham as a family. We didn't know a soul on our back patio. It was 80 degrees.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's crazy. It was a crazy difference. And lived down there for a while, changed same line of work with a different company, got transferred to Sacramento for a few years, ended up coming back up here. And then we worked up here for a while. That was for Georgia Pacific. They downsized and, reorganized or whatever corporations do when they want to, cook the books, basically. Mm-hmm. So they sold a bunch of distribution, sold a bunch of trucks, fired me and about 3,000 other people. And I ended up unemployed up here, and that's how I ended up working for the sheriff's office.
Wow. So were you in Los Angeles when they – you were in Los Angeles when they let you go, or did they move you back at that point?
No, I moved to Los Angeles with one company and was recruited from that company to Georgia Pacific.
Okay, I understand.
They relocated me to Sacramento in 91 and then relocated me again back up to Vancouver in – 98, yeah, something like that, 99.
And then left you go.
Yeah, I was up here for a couple of years. And it's a funny thing. Any salesman will tell you, companies treat salesmen really well until they don't need them, and then they're more expendable than the paper towels that are hanging in the bathroom.
It's true.
Because, salespeople bring in all the revenue, but they also cost a lot of money. And they're the first thing to go. In my case, I busted my hump out here for 7 years building distribution for a product that wasn't distributed by GP, west of the Rockies, basically. Opened 11 different distribution branches. And once those were open and working and they didn't need me anymore, I was out.
That's rotten.
So you get recruited by other companies for the people you know and the abilities that you have. And they're willing to pay you, and they treat you like you're a hero until they don't need you, and then they wad you up and throw you away. Yeah. So salespeople move around a lot for that reason. People who make a lot of money, executives, they use you for your skills and your talent, and when they get what they want, you're done. Which is probably why you have to make money while you're working, because it's...
yeah, it's like the executives. That's the reason why they make so much money, is that, once they're fired, who's going to rehire them as executives,
Yeah. They get the golden parachute.
Yeah. The salesman.
Yeah, you're fired, but here's $6 million for your trouble.
Yeah. I didn't
get that deal.
Yeah. I know. I've been fucked over by companies too.
Yeah, they're your best friend, and they'll play the guilt card to get your loyalty when it's something they want, and then when they're done with you, man, you're yesterday's news.
Yeah, I think it's bad. I think it's really bad in the culture, business culture and American culture that happens. There's no – I believe that, in the American dream, and I think that there's a social contract between, all Americans and businesses and the government and everything. So there should be some sort of,
Well, my dad's dad, my grandfather, he worked for – it's General Motors, but he worked in the Terex division, which makes the big – the huge, super huge dump trucks and steam shovels for mining and things like that. Mm-hmm. He worked there his whole life. He got out of the Air Force. In fact, I think he was joined or was drafted into the Air Force, had a career in the Air Force during the war, went back to Terex. His job was waiting for him when he got back because that's the kind of loyalty they had then. He worked there his entire life. He retired early. But I think he had 20 or 30 years in with him. But he had to retire early because of an illness. He had multiple sclerosis. They took care of him. He had his health insurance. He got his retirement. I mean, his whole life he spent there. My other grandfather worked for Union Pacific Railroad, retired with 35 years with them. Mm-hmm. My grandmother, his wife, who recently passed away, did 30 years with U.S. Bank. I mean, in their era, you got a job and you stayed there. But the new way of doing things is not like that. Georgia Pacific, as an example, when they let all of us go and closed distribution and things like that, they had done one of those deals with the executive where they fired the old guy with his golden parachute of millions of dollars and hired a new guy to drive the stock price up because that's what drives everything in business these days is your stock price. Well, they were unhappy with the value of their company. So what he did is he cut a bunch of people, which is expensive, He closed a bunch of distribution, which is expensive, sold all the equipment, which is expensive. So there was a blip on the books that said, wow, look at all the money we're making. Because they sold all those things and cut all those expenses. But the lag, the slack in sales wasn't showing up yet. It takes about a year. It takes all of your customers getting really upset with crappy service and crappy products to take their business elsewhere, and your sales go in the tank. Mm-hmm. Well, right before that happened, he jumped out and pulled the ripcord on his golden parachute and got all of his money, because that's what he was hired to do, is push the stock price up. And, you know, things went in the tank after that. So it wasn't a very far-sighted situation for them, but he got what he wanted.
Yeah. I'm wondering if somebody could – did that company go out of business or
– No. Georgia-Pacific is huge, and they have a paper division, which is still out here. They own mills, paper mills, and things like that. I worked in their building products division, siding, windows, insulation, roofing, stuff like that. Yeah. They closed all their distribution out here and consolidated their phone sales in Denver. They built a big, it's like a warehouse full of cubicles in Denver. So if you're Joe's Lumberyard in Bakersfield, California, and you dial the phone number for Georgia Pacific and you want to buy some roofing, the phone rings in Denver. A guy in Denver takes your order and then sends it over the computer to a distribution center, whichever one that they use closest to Bakersfield, and it gets put on a truck and sent to you. And in theory, it works, and it's cheap. But in reality, what those customers were used to was the guy being right there in Bakersfield, walking out and saying, yep, I'm looking at that stack of lumber, and it looks really good. You're going to be happy with it, putting it on a truck and bringing it the next day.
Yeah. Yeah.
What they're getting is some guy in Denver who doesn't even really know what you're talking about. He's just punching numbers into a computer, and the stuff's coming off a pile that might have been sitting outside for 8 months, and what you get is a crappy product. And then when you call, you get a guy who doesn't know what you're speaking. You're not even speaking English to him. Yeah. He's wearing a suit and tie looking at a computer, and you're talking to him about, you know, the railroad ties don't have enough creosote penetration into the lumber. And he doesn't know what that is. Yeah. So it, good theory, lousy in practice.
I know that trend. I worked in a music store for a long time, and it used to be when you went into a music store, you could always find somebody in the music store. It always, you could knew everything about different types of music. You could talk to them and find out new bands, and you know, you probably know that from buying music, right? But you don't have that nowadays. I mean, you go to a music store, those people don't know anything. They don't even know anything about the music that's new, you know?
No. And I'm constantly struck by how the internal workings of a store, something as simple as how do you enter it properly into the computer, take precedence over the needs of the customer. Mm-hmm. The internal problems, well, I can't do it that way because it won't fit into the computer. I can't punch it in that way. When all you really want is to exchange this title for that title. In simple terms, I hand you this one, you give me that one, and I leave. But their problems become your problems, and they don't care as much about you as a customer. It's like, it's almost like I'm going to sell this record whether you buy it or the next guy buys it. So I don't really care how I treat you. And then you get the people in the store. They're there for their $8 an hour. Something recently similar to that happened to me. I pulled into a gas station. I had my travel trailer behind my pickup.
Is this the picture you sent me?
Yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah. It's enormous. Yeah. Well, it's made to haul motorcycles and four-wheelers and sports quads and things like that. Mm. So it has its own gas tank. It has a gas tank that you fill up, and then it's got a little gas pump. So when you're out camping wherever you are, you can use that pump to fill up your individual machines instead of carrying gas cans.
Man.
It's got a little gas station on it.
Yeah.
So I pulled in there to fill that thing up, but it's huge. So I had to pull in, and I had to back up a little, and I had to pull in and get it straight. I had to wait for somebody. Well, I pull in. It was like 8:05. Mm-hmm. I pull into this gas station. I'm making the turn. I'm jockeying around. I'm backing up. I see a guy. A young kid, teenager, walking around outside, and he's, I don't know what he was doing, something. At first, I didn't realize he worked there. He wasn't dressed in a uniform or anything. But it turns out he worked there. So I pull into the pump. I got out. I got into my trailer to do something, to turn something on, or I noticed something. So I did that. I get out, and he's standing by my truck. And he says, could you back up a little because I can't get my car out? And I was like, sure. So I backed up a little bit. He gets in his car. He backs out. He waves at me, and he pulls out. He worked there. He was the only employee there. While I was getting my stuff situated, he closed the store, asked me to move, and went home.
Oh, my God.
Left me there. And I couldn't. He didn't say, we're closed, or I'm the only guy here, you're out of luck.
Yeah.
He just asked me to move and drove away. So I don't know. It's not like the guy that actually makes the money is working in the store anymore.
Yeah.
It's made a huge difference.
Yeah, it has. I remember when I was a kid, we had, you know, all the gas stations, like even golf stations, we know the owners, you know. It was like the same guy owned, and he gave you good service. And
When my grandparents lived in the Dalles, we got our hair cut by the guy that owned the barber shop. Mm-hmm. We bought our sporting goods from the guy that owned the sporting goods store. Yeah. It was always like that. Mm-hmm. It's a huge change, and it's not a good one, unfortunately.
No, it's not. No, it's not at all. You've been listening to The Flavis Show. You can reach me at 206-339-JOSE, or you can reach me at Kenty@theflatishow.com. Thank you for listening.